Scripture reading this morning is Luke chapter 2, verses 1 through 47. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover, and when he was 12 years old, they went up according to custom. And when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. His parents did not know it, but supposing him to be with the group, they went a day's journey, but then they began to search for him among their relatives and acquaintances, and when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem searching for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers.
Good morning. I've got about this much voice left, so you get about this much sermon. How about that? No one ever complained about getting to Speedy's early after the service, so I figured it'd be okay. With the holidays wrapping up and passing by, we've had a lot of opportunities for family gatherings of various sorts and types, opportunities to be with each other. And on postcards, those always look so beautiful and fantastic, and everyone gets along, and we all have matching pajamas, and everything is just right, and there's hot cocoa. In real life, we know any time that there involves actual people that we're related to, things are a little more complicated. And I love stories in the Bible that help remind us of that fact, and that Jesus himself was born into a family that had all the same obstacles of having to juggle the ordinariness of human family with the complicatedness of Jesus being Jesus. In fact, many of my favorite stories about Jesus begin in just that way, with something perfectly ordinary becoming something completely out of the ordinary because Jesus was involved. Last week, we talked about the story of Jesus being brought to the temple. And I made the comment that it was in many ways a very ordinary story, that Jewish families, when they have a child, will bring the baby up to the temple and a sacrifice would be made on his behalf. And that was done, you know, hundreds of times, thousands of times every year. It was a completely ordinary event in that regard that every Jewish family would have participated in. Except, as we said last week, you can't bring Jesus to the temple and have an ordinary day. Like two giant magnets of opposite poles, when they get close, they just snap together and something happens. And anytime Jesus gets near the temple, something exciting happens. So last week, it says the Spirit was on this person, Simeon, and he runs down and grabs the baby and starts to prophesy. And Anna is outside, and then these other people gathering around waiting for the Lord to do something, and all this excitement. And something ordinary becomes something very extraordinary. Something similar happens then in another story that only Luke tells us in Luke chapter 2, verses 1 through, I'm sorry, 41 and following. Luke chapter 2, 41 through following. It begins with the text that was just read for us a moment ago. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. You get that? That being told as an ordinary tale. This is, you have holiday rituals, you have things that you do every year at the same time. We're going to make a trip down here. We do this every year, and we have a certain trip we have to make, we have to do certain things. They took time every year, it was just planned. They're going to go down to the temple at the Passover because they were close enough they could do that. Most people tried to make it to the temple at least once in their life, but people that lived close enough to the temple, yeah, you could travel down every year if you'd like and make an event of it, especially at certain important times of the year. So at the Feast of the Passover, his family goes down, and when Jesus was 12 years old, they went up according to custom. Luke's using as many words as possible to give you the ordinariness of this story. But this is just the kind of thing they did, and this time Jesus comes along, and this is where the trouble starts. Because you can't get Jesus that close to the temple without something extraordinary happening. And so when they think they're good and done, verse 43, and when the feast was ended, as they were returning, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. His parents did not know it. But supposing him to be in the group, they went a day's journey. But when they began to search for him among their relatives and acquaintances, and when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem searching for him. Even at this point, the story is still fairly ordinary, because I suspect every parent at some point has simply misplaced a child. We've all done it. We have to own up to it. It's one of those things that we pay psychiatrists for later in life. Some of us did it on purpose. Some of us did it on accident. But at some point, we've all left a child behind. And we know, even though the text doesn't spell out every detail, we kind of know the phases of what was happening on this little caravan going back a day's journey. That it would have started out with terror, right? That the first feeling that grips your stomach is, actually, no, I don't know where my child is. And from terror, you quickly pivot to anger, because somebody is to blame, obviously, and it's the other spouse. I would like to have been there, just my strange curiosity. I would have liked to have heard the argument between Joseph and Mary that must have ensued on the trip back. I thought you had him. I thought you had him. Well, I left him with your Aunt Edna. Well, Aunt Edna lost her mule last year. How would you leave our baby with Aunt Edna? Speaking of mules, where's your mother? Why isn't she looking? And on, you can just imagine the kind of thing. Because we've had that argument. All of us have had that argument. When something goes wrong, we start blaming everyone and fighting. And then it even says in the text, they're looking among the relatives, they're talking to acquaintances, and on and on. And they start making their way back a day's journey. So even though this is a little bit out of the ordinary, it's ordinary enough that we all recognize it. We know kind of that frantic, something has gone wrong feeling. Just last night, give you my own something went wrong story. Just last night, we were watching a very sad football game. And we were watching this game, and I'll admit, I wasn't paying very much attention to Calvin. And Calvin apparently wanted some popcorn. Wanted some popcorn so much that he went to the kitchen to make his own popcorn in the microwave using an oatmeal packet instead of popcorn. And so he comes into our room telling us, hey, there's some milk in the kitchen. Well, it sounded to me like milk in the kitchen. Apparently that was Calvinese for smoke in the kitchen. And so we tell Lucas, because I'm watching the game, important stuff going on here, we're losing. And I send Lucas, could you go check and see what's going on if he spilled some milk in the kitchen? Hey, we need a fire extinguisher. And that's when your heart, you know, clenches up and you think, well, this is it. This is the day we've waited for. And it's this terrible feeling. And immediately you start blaming. Why didn't you make him popcorn? Why didn't you make him popcorn? Aunt Betsy didn't make him popcorn. You know, and you start to blame, and you can understand that feeling. So all of this, my point is, this whole story is very, very ordinary, except for the fact that Jesus is in the middle of it. And when Jesus is involved, nothing can be ordinary, especially what it involves the temple. They took Jesus to the temple, and something was bound to happen. So when you read the next passage, then in verse 46, after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. And when his parents saw him, they were astonished. That feeling, even that, we can kind of appreciate. Most parents, at some point in their life, see their child doing something good. I have to qualify that. See their child doing something good that surprises them. Like, there's plenty of times in your life when you see them doing something bad that surprises you. Smoke coming out of the kitchen, etc. But every parent has that experience. When your child does something that is more mature and more selfless and more thoughtful and more virtuous than you thought they were ready to do yet. And you're just genuinely shocked by, well, is that my kid doing that? And that's also the feeling that we have described here, is the parents look. Only with Jesus, it's not merely a good deed or a kind word or he did extra good in Bible class. He is sitting in the midst of the temple among the leaders of the temple. These are not simply country rabbis. These are the best of the best. And they're discussing the Bible in a way that is apparently engaging. Apparently going on in a way that they can discuss Scripture and everyone's kind of impressed with what the young man is asking and what the young man is saying. The questions themselves, you know, there are kid questions and then there's grown-up questions. He's asking grown-up questions about the text. And his answers to his own questions seem to be better than theirs. And everyone is a fair bit impressed. And his parents have this moment of astonishment. But then we go a step further. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I have been searching for you in great distress." And he said to them, "Why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be in my father's house?" The English Standard here reads a little bit differently than some translations will, and I'm going to say I agree this time with the English Standard's rendering. The traditional rendering is, "I must be about my father's business." And there's nothing wrong with that language. It's not a bad translation. It's more about better and best in this case. That's an adequate translation. A better translation of the text in this case is a reference to the place where he's standing. It's not just, "I was doing my father's business," but "I must be in my father's place of business. I must be in my father's house." The question is, why are you looking for me? Where else would I possibly be? Where else would Jesus possibly be but in the temple? Like magnets snapped together. Of course, this is where he's supposed to be. And what that gives to us is Jesus at an early age. On the one hand, we know he is God made flesh, but he's also a human child developing. And at an early age, he puts an emphasis and a priority on the house of God that really carries on and defines his entire life. If you read through the book of Luke, the house of God simply comes up time and time and time again. In Luke, the fourth chapter, when Satan tempts Jesus in the wilderness, in verse 9 and following, he takes him to the pinnacle of the temple. And he sees that as significant to Jesus, that if in temptation he could take Jesus to the temple, he could accomplish something there that he couldn't accomplish somewhere else. That Jesus had some significance in that temple, and one of the temptations is framed in that location. In Luke, the ninth chapter, in verse 51, if you want to just flip over there briefly, Luke, the ninth chapter, in verse 51, Jesus' interest in Jerusalem and the temple is so significant that it actually is off-putting to other people. In Luke chapter 9, in verse 51, when the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And he sent messengers ahead of him, who went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make preparations for him. But the people did not receive him because his face was set toward Jerusalem. That his intent in his travel, this little section of Luke from chapter 9, verse 51, all the way through to about chapter 18, is sometimes called Luke's travel narrative. Because it seems like every paragraph or so, Luke says, "and they were traveling to Jerusalem." That he wants you to keep in mind through all these stories that this is part of a long, winding campaign where Jesus had one thing in mind all the way through, and that was, "I'm making my way to the temple. I'm making my way to the temple." And you just know the stage is set, and something important is going to happen when he gets there. If you've been on our final days of Jesus class on Sunday morning, when he gets there, something happens. There's the parade, the spectacle of the triumphal entry. And he comes into the city, and he makes his way through town. And he goes up, in Mark's account, to the temple itself, takes a look around, and then goes back home to Bethany. And then on Monday morning, he comes back, and he cleanses the temple. This recorded for us in Luke 19, 45 and 48, he cleanses the temple and makes a point about how it's been corrupted. This was supposed to be my father's house, a house of prayer. You've turned it into a den of thieves. The next day, he comes back to the temple on Tuesday, and all day on Tuesday, he's answering questions in the temple, he's rebuking people in the temple, he's chastising the temple leadership. And then at the end of that day, if you're in the auditorium class this morning, as he's leaving the temple, he takes a parting shot and says, "This temple will have to fall." And he goes out into the Mount of Olives, and Mark says, overlooking the temple, his disciples ask, "When will these things be?" And he starts to tell them about the temple. And he prophesies its fall in Luke 22 and verse 52. And then finally, when they go to arrest him in the Mount of Olives later in that same week, Jesus himself remarks on how often he had been in the temple. They come in the middle of night into the garden with torches and pitchforks to arrest him. And he says, "Wasn't I with you every day in the temple? But you didn't want to do anything there." The gospel accounts also tell us that at the time of his death, the temple itself began to mourn. And there is a great curtain in the middle of the temple. This is not a linen curtain, right? This is not a decorative curtain. This is a partition. If you go into our fellowship hall, we have a retractable partition you can close off a room with. And it's made of thick material. It's designed to separate one side of the room from the other. History tells us, Jewish history tells us, that the veil, as we call it in the temple, was enormously thick material. And it was made to partition off portions of the temple, the holiness of God on the other side. It wasn't thin linen. And yet at the time of Jesus' death, the Gospels tell us that that veil tears like a tissue. The temple itself begins to mourn. Folks, what we see in the life of Jesus from his early age onward that Luke is getting our attention, the temple, the house, the things, the business of God mattered first in the life of Jesus. And everything he did revolved around that principle. The lesson that I want us to take home today from this early story of Jesus and the entire story of Jesus. In the next few days, I hope you'll be thinking about the coming year and your priorities for the next year and what you want to put first and what you want to accomplish. I hope the things of God take the first place in that list of priorities. I think when you look at your life, you have the same kind of incredulity that Jesus has. Well, what else would I put first? Where else would I be but in my Father's house? What else could possibly be my first priority besides the house of God and his work? Christ also tells us in John the 14th chapter that people who put that house first have a place in that house. Jesus, speaking of the house that rests above, says, "In my Father's house are many rooms, and if it were not so, I would have told you, and I go to prepare a place for you." Christ tells us that when we put God's things and God's business and God's house above all other earthly priorities, there is a place welcoming there for us. Put that as your highest joy and your greatest delight. Make it your first goal in the coming year. And like the child Jesus, let the world know that you are exactly where you're supposed to be. Not lost and confused in a myriad of priorities. Exactly where you're supposed to be, in the house of God. We're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. If we can do anything to help you, won't you come?